Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Tonight, we'll talk about a new option for salivary gland surgery.
As any other malignancy, if they're detected early and treated appropriately, patients tend to do very well. If they present late in the game, the prognosis is not as good.
Plus, how the medical team responds when police face an active shooter situation.
Because police officers are now going into the scene quickly, we're trying to get paramedics and EMTs to also enter the scene under escort by police, but to help save lives quickly.
And mental health patients share hope through poetry and prose.
So the idea of this book was to tap those parts of self that would assist others.
You'll get your checkup from the neck up, and our healing muse will share a new selection. That's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, in light of all the mass shootings nationally, we'll learn how emergency medical staff and local law enforcement are preparing. Plus, have you ever thought what it might be like to be a psychiatric inpatient? Well, we'll hear some poignant and enlightening musings as these patients find peace in the midst of their storm. But first, a new breakthrough, minimally invasive technique for surgery of the salivary glands. Well, just like all the other organs of the body, our salivary glands can develop cancerous growths, as well as inflammatory and obstructive diseases that often require surgical intervention. In fact, malignant salivary gland neoplasms account for 3-5% of all the head and neck cancers. Well, joining us to share a new minimally invasive salivary gland surgical procedure is Dr. Mark Marzuk. He's assistant professor of otolaryngology and communication sciences and the new division chief of head and neck oncologic surgery at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Marzuk. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start a little bit to help us understand, what are salivary gland tumors? What exactly are they?
So salivary gland tumors can be benign or malignant neoplasms. We have three major salivary glands in our head and neck region and about 1,000 minor salivary glands.
Wow.
Yes.
Had no idea.
Right. The major glands are the parotid glands, and this is the gland that lives in front of the ear. On the cheek area, and there is a submandibular gland which lives underneath the jaw, and hence the name submandibular, and two sublingual glands that live underneath the tongue. These are the major glands. The minor glands are distributed through the mouth, the throat, and the voice box. Most of the tumors that grow from the parotid gland, for example, the vast majority of those are benign neoplasms, and they are fairly asymptomatic. Patients start to notice them as a growth, where they feel it when they shave, for example, if they're males, or if a friend alert the patient telling that your face is kind of different. But they grow slowly. Over time, most of the time, they are asymptomatic. They just show up as a mass. In the condition of malignant neoplasms, they also can present as a neoplasm, as a mass, but they, due to their malignant nature, they start to invade surrounding structures. And the most important one of those is a facial nerve. And that becomes really noticeable because the patient would have asymmetry in their face, especially when they smile or they wink, or that becomes cosmetically very noticeable problem. Another presentation is when it presents with lymph node enlargement. So the growth is not necessarily in the gland itself, but rather in lymph nodes throughout the neck.
So they might find a swelling or something on their neck.
Exactly.
Or somewhere else.
So that's what we call metastatic disease.
So you can have neurologic symptoms. You can just have swell. I'm talking about with the more malignant type, neurologic symptoms if it affects the facial nerve, or you can have growths elsewhere in the body as
right.
well.
Right, and some of those are painful if they are malignant.
So what is done for them? I mean, what's generally the type of treatment that's done for these types of growths?
So for major salivary glands, as I mentioned, the parotid glands or submandibular glands, and even the sublingual glands, a primary treatment that provides the best outcome is surgery. And that can sometimes be the only treatment modality, but it can also be followed by radiation therapy or chemotherapy as well.
So again, depending on perhaps the grade or the stage and all of
that. That is correct. Primarily the pathology, so we get a biopsy first and determine what kind of tumor we're dealing with. Some patients who are not a good candidate for surgery, they can only get radiation therapy and chemotherapy in some circumstances.
What's the prognosis for those kinds of malignant tumors?
So as any other kind of malignancy, it obviously depends on the time of presentation and how late in the process we detect that tumor. As any other malignancy, if they're detected early and treated appropriately, patients tend to do very well. But unfortunately, if they present late in the game where they present with a metastatic disease, as I mentioned, in the lymph nodes or even in the lungs or other distant organ, the prognosis is not as good.
Are they doing, and I knew we're going to be talking a little bit more about a new procedure that you're involved with that's minimally invasive for different types of disease, but with these types of tumors, are they now doing less invasive or less open procedures to resolve these, the cancer tumors?
So the standard surgery as of now for major salivary gland tumors is an open procedure. There is no laser, for example, or any other less invasive procedures. For parotid glands, people have described a less invasive procedure in terms of the size of the incision, if you will, mm-hmm. but that has always been described for more benign tumors, as I mentioned, which is the majority of the parotid glands, fortunately, are benign. We can use a more cosmetic incision that we use for facelift, for example. So that tend to be cosmetically be more appealing than the traditional surgery.
Is there some danger, though, with doing any kind of surgery to remove some of those tumors, of having permanent damage to the facial nerve or permanent problems following it?
Absolutely. This is the most concerning complication of parotid and submandibular gland surgery, which is the facial nerve injury. It is an inherent risk of the procedure since the facial nerve runs through the parotid gland. So in order to remove a tumor, you actually should go down to the facial nerve so you can see it and protect it and then peel the tumor away from it. Mm-hmm. So by doing that, you're obviously putting a risk at injuring that nerve. It can be a temporary weakness, but if the nerve gets cut during surgery, that's obviously a permanent morbidity.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here along with otolaryngologist Dr. Mark Marzuk, and we're talking about tumors or disorders of the salivary gland and a new treatment option. Well, there are other salivary gland problems that you can have, disorders that involve inflammation or obstructive things, and tell me what those are, and now you have a new technique that is less invasive than what we just talked about.
Right. So the other problems that major salivary gland can have is obstruction. So basically it becomes like a blooming problem, if you will. Mm-hmm. The saliva is being produced within the substance of the gland, and it gets collected through small tubes that join each other and form a large duct, and that opens into the mouth to empty the saliva inside the mouth. So sometimes this tube gets clogged with either a stone or a thick secretion, and that results in a backup of the salivary flow into the gland. and that results in enlargement of the gland. It gets swollen, it gets painful, and as any other stagnant fluid, it is a good medium for bacteria.
So inflammation.
Right, that can lead to an infection, and that becomes really painful condition and painful swelling of the gland that prompt most patients to go to their primary care doctor or even emergency room with severe painful swellings that start abruptly in a matter of hours.
Oh, okay, so it can come on very acutely.
That's right.
How is that different? If you were to have that those symptoms, how is that different? Or is that part of the differential for also a tumor in that salivary gland?
Right.
In other words?
We keep always the neoplastic process on our mind all of the time because right. obviously you don't want to miss that. But it's very unlikely that a tumor or a neoplasm present with an acute swelling. And the other thing is with obstructive process, like a stone, the process gets recurrent. It's not one time. So sometimes they get it not as bad, stay 1 or 2 days and resolve, and then a month later or 2 months later, they get another episode of a swelling. So tumors don't usually do that.
They progressively get worse.
Right. They progress usually slowly. They don't result in acute symptoms or pain unless they are late in the process if they are malignant.
But the point is, it's part of your differential if someone were to come to you with an acute onset still to determine whether there could be a tumor at the core of this
Absolutely.
Problem.
Right. Absolutely.
But let's say absent that, and it finds out that it's basically some kind of inflammatory process or some kind of obstruction, what would you do to treat it in addition or with surgery? What would you do?
Right. So in the acute phase, you have to make the diagnosis, and this diagnosis can be clinical. It can be as simple as feeling that stone in the duct underneath the tongue or in the cheek. That way you can make the diagnosis. The most reliable way is to obtain imaging study, and that's usually a CT scan, which showed the enlargement of the gland or the swelling, and it also shows what we call a radio-opaque or a very bright concretion of stone mm-hmm. in the duct, and that
so
makes
most
the
frequently
difficult.
is it caused by stones? Is that
is the most common cause of acute swelling in a salivary glands?
Do we know what causes these stones?
We don't know the exact etiology of that, but we do know that people who are generally dehydrated or don't drink enough water tend to have stones more than the general population.
And are those people also potentially at risk for kidney stones or other kinds of stones throughout the body?
Right. There were studies trying to link those to each other. We couldn't reach what can be scientifically significant or statistically significant, that people who have these stones tend to form salivary gland stones, but it makes sense.
Hypothetically,
that
anyway.
Way. That's right.
I don't want to run out of time. In the time we have left, tell me about this new procedure. What are its benefits? How do you do it?
Right. So this procedure is called salivary endoscopy or silendoscopy. This has been going on in Europe since the 1990s, but it didn't come to the United States till 2006. It's a minimally invasive procedure in a way that we don't make any cuts or incisions.
Wow.
We go through, as I mentioned, the tube or the duct opens into the mouth. So we find that opening, we enlarge it without incisions, we just dilate it, and we insert our camera, which is about 1 millimeter camera, if
wow.
you can imagine. It's a fairly small tube, and we have a very high resolution image on a monitor that's a high definition monitor, so you can see what's inside that tube. And once you encounter an area of narrowing, or if you encounter the stone, you can introduce a wire basket through it, and you harvest that stone and come out without any incision.
So you basically solve the problem,
right?
Without any cutting,
exactly.
So what are the benefits? Obviously, no cutting,
right? The major benefit, as far as I'm concerned, is, and I always mention to my patient, it's the same story like if you have a kidney stone. your urologist does not recommend removing a kidney if you have a stone, but rather removing it because this kidney is functioning. The salivary gland is also functioning. There is no reason to take it out just because it's obstructed if you can remove the obstruction. So it's a same-day surgery procedure. You can go home same day. There's no incisions. There's no restrictions of your activity afterwards. It can actually be done in the office.
Yeah, so is it under general anesthesia
right,
or
so
local?
Right, so most of my patients who have smaller stones that can be harvested easily with the camera can be done in the office with local anesthesia, and they resume all their activities thereafter.
Well, that's amazing. Is this is highly specialized. Is it done locally? Is it widely done?
Right. As I mentioned, it just started in the United States very recently, so there are very few numbers of centers around the country who have the expertise to perform this. So in the immediate area, I think Upstate is the only hospital in the region that provides that technology.
Well, thank you so much for coming in and sharing it with us. It's very hopeful information. Yes. My guest has been Dr. Mark Marzouk. He's Assistant Professor of Otolaryngology and Communication Sciences and the new Division Chief of Head and Neck Oncologic Surgery. Next up, how are medical emergency staff and law enforcement preparing for the next active shooter? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Well, according to a recent study by the FBI, the number of incidents in which a shooter opens fire on a crowd of people more than doubled over the past 7 years, with the most recent tragedy happening in Charleston, South Carolina, where a gunman opened fire, killing 9 church members who had gathered for a Bible study and prayer at one of the nation's oldest black churches. Such events have brought to light the real risk and absolute horror of what law enforcement and EMS responders must be prepared to face. So how can emergency medical response teams be ready for this, and how can the medical teams be trained to respond to save as many lives as possible? Well, here with some answers is Dr. Christian Knudsen. He's Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine at Upstate Medical University. Welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Linda.
So let's begin by defining what we mean when we use the term active shooter. What does that mean?
Active shooter is any time someone with a weapon goes into a crowd or a place with lots of people with the intent to hurt or to kill as many people as possible. We usually think of it as being a gun or a rifle, but it can even be knives. There's a case in China a couple of years ago. In a subway, with the gentleman with knife hurt 30 to 40 people. So anytime someone with a weapon goes into a crowd to hurt someone.
And it's kind of random killing. It's not even always a pattern to it. It's just random outburst of some kind.
Right. They shoot for most attention, most number of people hurt, effect, not always just a target of one person.
So what protocols currently are in place to help avert the loss of life? I mean, what are first responders trained to do to stop the killing?
Traditionally, police and EMS used to stay back. In Columbine, years ago, the police and the EMS would stay back and kind of prepare themselves and then enter a school or a building to take out an active shooter. Obviously, in Columbine, that 30 to 40 minute delay they had of kind of getting their teams ready to go in cost lives and cost time. Police have changed their tactics where now they are trained to go in and confront somebody. So instead of waiting, as soon as they get on scene and they know there's a bad guy inside, they don't wait. Either one or two police officers will enter a building with the goal of confronting and either distracting or killing the bad guy.
And similarly, EMS have changed the way they handle it as well. Yeah. What is this idea of tactical EMS? What is that?
That's the more traditional role of EMS with police officers. if you take a paramedic or an EMT and integrate them into a SWAT team, they provide medical support for the SWAT team. So they can take care of the SWAT members if they get hurt, lacerations, sports injuries, and also they can take care of suspects and bystanders on the scene with the team when they go into a high-risk situation.
But the idea was that it's changed, though, hasn't it? Because at one time, I understood that, you know, the ambulances, the paramedics, all of those people would stage nearby and wait for a safe moment to come in and to try to help people.
Right.
But that's begun to change.
Right.
How?
Because police officers are now going into the scene quickly. They're realizing there are people who are hurt, especially in large buildings. Virginia Tech, for instance, was a Norris Hall. They had multiple rooms, multiple hallways.
That was Virginia Tech, yes, at that university, right.
And while they actually had tactical EMS, they were right on scene, and they got into multiple rooms and saved lives because they could treat bleeding arms or legs, treat chest wounds. And they saved several lives with their rapid treatment. But because now police are going in so fast, we're trying to get paramedics and EMTs to also enter the scene under escort by police, but to help save lives quickly.
So now EMS are moving in, or these types of first responders are moving into an unsecure area, is what you're saying.
Less secure.
Less secure.
I think traditionally EMS would sit back and wait for the scene, as we say, scene safe. Make sure police were on scene, make sure the shooter was secure. They're still under escort, and they're going into areas which have been cleared by police, so it is safer, but it's more risk than they were traditionally trained to accept.
So what are they doing when they do that? I mean, and why would police want EMS in there, kind of in their way, potentially?
Or, mm-hmm.
I mean, what's the real benefit there?
Law enforcement's job is to stop the shooter, but also they recognize while they're moving forward, there are people who are hurt. And while police can do some basic interventions, it's good to have people trained in medical care, trauma care, to come in and treat those victims as quickly as possible.
So there are what they call, and I think you identified for me prior to our talking, there are three types of injuries. There are ones that are not survivable, so someone is going to die regardless. Someone survivable without care.
Yes.
And those that really need immediate care.
Yes.
So it's a triage that's going on immediately also that an EMS person could help with.
Yes.
And then what type of care is offered if they're survivable with care? What are the kinds of injuries that you take care of and how?
The three main injuries are airway problems breathing, injuries to the neck, open wounds to the chest, where you have a collapsed lung, which can compromise blood flow to the heart. Or most common, you have bleeding wounds in the arms and legs. And those can be treated either with tourniquets, which are now widely available in the past 5 or 10 years, or hemostatic agents, things you can put onto the wounds and apply pressure, and they help stop bleeding.
So it's crucial, in a way, for these EMS responders to really be involved, kind of integrated into these SWAT teams and be part and parcel of the whole process.
Not just the SWAT teams, but with law enforcement in general. So you have not just tactical teams going into these situations, but you have your street cops, your regular officers going in. So not only are you having tactical medics trained, but you're having basic ambulance crews, regular ambulance crews, being trained at many large cities to also go into these situations.
Wow.
So it's not just training the SWAT team, but the entire police and the entire EMS system as well.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with emergency medicine physician Dr. Christian Knutson, and we're talking about active shooter situations and how the training has changed for both emergency medical personnel as well as for the law enforcement side of it. So tell us a little bit more about what, you know, the change in police tactics and how this change is really changing EMS. For example, there's something called a rescue task force now, RTF. What is that?
That's a task force is a group of people from different agencies. So the idea of the rescue task force is when the police first go into an active shooter situation and then another police officer and an ambulance arrives on scene, the combination of the police officer and the EMT or the paramedic is kind of considered the rescue task force. The first officers in are called the contact team because they're pushing forward trying to get the bad guy. The next group, the combination of police and EMS, would be considered the rescue task force. And that's where the new training needs to come in to train law enforcement and train EMS to work together, to get used to each other, and to know how each other work and cooperate together to go forward and take care of patients.
So that is a challenge. In a way, what I'm hearing is that both groups are kind of meeting in the middle.
Yeah.
Where police were not doing any kind of medical help, and EMT were not doing any kind of stop the shooter concept, now both are having to be ready to do a little of both.
Right. The officers always will stop the shooter, but the
right.
EMS now needs to start deciding if they're going to accept the risk of moving forward. And police need to know how to protect the EMS because EMS traditionally does not have body armor or helmets or weapons to protect themselves. So they need the police to provide an escort to keep them safe because these situations are always fluid and always changing.
Rapidly.
You have to be careful and be ready for whatever happens. So that task force is crucial.
So how is an EMS person trained then differently to become part of one of these task forces?
Across the country, there are multiple different ways this is happening. In New York, the Department of Homeland Security now has a new rescue task force training course in Buffalo, which is new, I think, in the past year. We may try to bring that to Syracuse to help treat local EMS. Locally, Upstate's Physician Response Team and Syracuse Police are working together with Rural Metro to bring these training days together. We've had one so far where we've had Rural Metro's supervisors and Syracuse Police's SWAT team and officers do one day of training to kind of get used to how they work together. More are planned. They haven't happened yet. But those days, just seeing each other and working together, are crucial to working together in the future.
Right. So basically, they each have to understand what the priorities are of each group.
Yes.
In other words, police have to understand what the EMS's priorities are in that situation. Obviously, safety, but
right.
Then what kind of cover they need. And similarly, the EMS people have to understand what are the priorities of the police and not necessarily to get in their way and
yes.
what have you.
Communication and trust are crucial. So they know what each other's doing. And when an officer says, do something, you do it. Or when EMS says, we need to do this, they know what each other's doing. So that interaction, that trust is important for the
future.
Are
police themselves or law enforcement, are they being trained in doing some medical intervention in
yes.
certain circumstances, and especially if one of their own number perhaps is injured?
Yeah, with the importance of tourniquets and bleeding agents to stop bleeding arms and legs, most police officers are given trauma kits, where they have the tourniquet or they have a hemostatic agent and they're trained how to use it either from inside training or training provided by EMS agencies so that if they go into a situation, they can treat themselves if they're hurt or if the shooter is stopped, they can turn around and start taking care of injured patients as well.
So they have to also understand triage concepts
they
and
do.
Things of that nature. I mean, what has to be done first and who
yep.
are the people who could be saved versus
recognizing sick or not sick and who needs their care first.
So there's really a lot to be gained, it sounds to me, from both groups working together
yes.
and learning each other's needs and others' priorities and also other skill sets.
It's a big change in how they work. They used to have different silos and work in those silos, but now things are getting mixed up and they're working much more closely together than they were before.
It strikes me that those kinds of skill sets, though, could be carried beyond a circumstance of just an active shooter. It could be almost any catastrophe that
right.
were to happen where there's a need for law enforcement and first responders.
Right. Rampage shooters are shooters not just who are trying to go across a large amount of area and hurt people, kind of like the Washington, D.C. shipyards. So there are barricaded situations. It's good to have EMS and police know how to work for multiple situations.
And you feel at this point we're in the early stages locally, but this is happening and we plan to go forward. But on a national level, this really is taking place.
I think it's taking place mostly in large cities, Philadelphia, D.C., New York City, West Coast, main cities. And it's kind of spreading from there to Syracuse, Rochester, Albany. And then from there, I'd have to move to the smaller agencies and more the suburbs. But I think over the next 5-10 years, this will be increasingly common to get this kind of training, especially as we get it set up and us, the physicians and EMS and law enforcement, get used to the training. We get it better and make it more common and make it more available to everybody.
I think it really is a tremendous added benefit to the public to know that we have that kind of training going on, and the fact that we have that kind of a team approach to any kind of situation like that, because it's awfully frightening and things are happening so rapidly.
Yes.
Thank you so much for coming in and sharing that information with us. It's hopeful information. My guest has been Dr. Christian Knudsen. He's Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine at Upstate Medical University. And I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up, peekaboo. Well, folks, one of the things I really love is playing peekaboo with babies and toddlers on a bus, train, plane, with a little person a row or two in front, curiously gazing in my direction, or in mom or dad's arms in the supermarket or on an elevator or wherever. Big mistake, baby. Peek-a-boo. Then, watching them wonder, what is this guy doing? I don't even know him. And then usually shyly hiding behind mom or dad's neck, perhaps never to be eyeball to eyeball again, but often, joyfully often, carefully sneaking another peek, hiding again, then peeking, me peek back, then the blissful sunburst smile, and hopefully that wonderful whole body squiggly squirm, pure pleasure, squirmy joy for two, please. Now, lately, I've been exploring something similar with fellow grown-ups, not exactly peekaboo, but same goal, funaboo. What have I discovered? No simple eyes behind fingers recipe yet, but it often involves a bit of risk, talking to someone you usually wouldn't, perhaps about something you usually don't, always positive with a dash of humor or appreciation about the real and now. Like on the phone with some company's nice phone person, I said, "You've been helpful and friendly. I like both. Tell your boss a happy customer said you deserve a raise." Or, "Great hat," to the brave one strolling by in fedorial sartorial splendor. Or to the young man I asked for directions, who, as he turned to look at me, I saw sported a waxy, wispy, pin-pointy handlebar mustache. Cool stash, man. And then playful fun right back at me. "Thanks. A raise would be great. I'll play her the tape." And, "Great hat yourself, dude." And plain old thanks. All three with that wonderful, always delightful thing called a smile. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Dr. Rich O'Neill.
Next, what it's like to be a psychiatric inpatient in their own words. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Hospitalization for psychiatric care can be challenging to the patient and their family. Well, here with a new publication that seeks to help is Reverend Terry Culbertson. She's from the Department of Spiritual Care at Upstate Medical University. Welcome.
Thank you so much for coming, Linda. Yeah.
So hospitalization for psychiatric treatment really has to be a very challenging experience for patients. Tell us about it from your experience as a chaplain.
Particularly in the arena of psychiatric care, it's a situation where a lot of people come who feel like their life has no meaning, or that there's no purpose to their life anymore. We have a lot of people that are admitted because of what we call a suicidal ideation, very despairing or depressed. there's people with chronic psychiatric issues too. So it's a real mix, but it's a lot of people out there. And we do tend to see people who come back.
So there's a desperation to their experience when they finally end up in a psychiatric institution or psychiatric hospitalization.
Right. It's probably more despair than desperation in some ways, or just that there's no hope.
Mm. Yeah. So this new project then that you undertook, mm-hmm. what is an attempt to provide some kind of help. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the project. What exactly is it? And what was its mission, or what is its mission?
This project is, we in spiritual care try to think very broadly about how to best assist people. There are traditional religious methods, such as prayer and scripture, but one of the things that I think is extremely important is the issue of creativity and having a way to contribute oneself to assist others, and in a way that... I don't think I can quote it for you, Linda, but it's in service that we find meaning. So the idea of this book was a spiritual project, essentially, to tap those parts of self that would assist a person in feeling like their life had purpose.
So it was almost a jump start for someone who might be in that place of great despair.
Exactly.
And see that something that they felt or knew or mm-hmm. had within them could perhaps be helpful to others.
Exactly. And I think knowing that others are in your boat, you know, it's very, one of the things when one is very sad or lonely or depressed is feeling like we're the only ones. And this is telling us that there's many people that have struggled with this and you're not alone.
So the book is called Peace in the Midst of the Storm, and that actually is a quote, a biblical quote, isn't it, in some ways?
Now you're going to test me here.
No.
I don't think it is. It's really an image from a scriptural reference, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
And in any case, the concept here was that there would be some way of finding some peace in the midst of one's personal storm.
Yes.
But so what's in the book, basically?
The book is actually a number of chapters of, I would call them small seminars or almost like a workshop for folks that were on the units inpatient and that practiced these exercises to see what they could learn about themselves and then offer that to others.
So the book has within it, though, poems, mm-hmm. letters, songs, and stories as well.
Exactly.
And they're written by these inpatients.
Exactly.
As part of this workshop idea or mm-hmm. an opportunity to kind of have some self-reflection, perhaps, on
exactly.
their own experiences.
I think that's the perfect word, self-reflection, and an opportunity to... express oneself, what's inside.
So once again, why do this? I mean, you're saying you're always looking for a way to help. Mm-hmm. And I think you have had other experiences of writing, of publishing, mm-hmm. things of this nature. But what specifically was it, the whole idea of this idea of isolation and trying to help people feel less alone?
I think it was also that everyone has something to contribute. And it's such a powerful thing, then, to be asked to contribute and publish something when you can hardly even write or express yourself, but that there's a sense of respect and dignity in that. And I think there was an excitement in feeling like we're part of something bigger than ourselves.
So what are the themes that you would say come out of it? I mean, something like forgiveness, is it gratitude, is there any hope in it?
Well, there's definitely hope. There's certainly the theme of love and the theme of hope, for sure. Overcoming, I think, adversity is a really key thing, that we're more than conquerors. And peace and acceptance of some things that can't be changed. It's like the serenity prayer. Mm-hmm. So that's very important, too. And then what gives strength to withstand one's storm, one's hospitalization, or one's mental challenges.
What are the elements that allow one to, maybe develop resilience or have a sense of resilience?
I think that's it. I mean, there's a sense of that we're all wounded in some fashion. And how do we manage to live our lives fully as we can? So that's certainly a big part of it.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with Reverend Terry Culbertson. We're talking about a project to ease the pain of hospitalized psychiatric patients. And this book, Peace in the Midst of a Storm, really sounds like it has that potential. Now, it was put together, an interesting way that you did this. You had an intern student.
Yes.
What did she do exactly? Tell us how the process took place.
Well, we have a relationship here at Upstate with something called Synergy Mercy Works, which has been in existence through, I believe it's our Office of Diversity, for over 7 years. And every year we in spiritual care apply for an intern. This particular intern is Sequoia Kemp. She is a matriculating student at the University of Rochester, wants to be a midwife. And this became her summer project last year, was to really work on those units, engage with the patients, run the seminars, and gather together these wonderful stories and poems and songs.
So this really was her baby, so to speak.
It became her baby, yeah. Very much.
Yeah.
And she has a wonderful singing voice also, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the book has, besides the fact that it has these actual, stories and poems and all of that, it has areas within the book where you could literally have some kind of an exercise, and there are lined pages where people are encouraged to write
mm-hmm.
themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not only the sharing of what has been written, but the encouragement to write more.
Exactly. And one thing that's used on our units is journals that's often given out at admission. So this is like an accompaniment to that. And the book is for writing in and learning about oneself.
How did the patients who participated or contributed, how did they feel about this, or how do they feel about this book?
Well, when I was last summer with Sequoia, my experience of the patients was they were excited, that they felt like, wow, you mean somebody's going to ask us to actually contribute something, and feeling part of this greater whole. And a lot of folks know each other from the years of being in our community and our system. So it just was a very exciting feeling for the group, I think, each time.
And this is basically, there were 45 individuals mm-hmm. who contributed?
Yes.
That's quite significant.
Yeah, I thought it was too.
Yeah. So did you brought us something that you said you'd like to just give us a little taste of what's in the book.
Sure.
So you have something very...
I thought I might just read from the section. It's called Who Am I? It's based on the I Am poems, which I think come out of actually the work of Fikrat Khan. And we start with a quote from Deepak Chopra. We have to really educate ourselves in a way about who we are and what our real identity is. So this is a poem by A. A writes, I'm a drunk and emotional man and confused at times. I am loving. I wonder about afterlife and heaven. I hear songs and music. I see beauty and calmness. I want to smile in my soul. I am emotional and confused at times. I pretend to be fine. I feel the presence of kindness. I touch my pets. I worry about the past. I am emotional and confused at times. I understand love is love. I say, I hear ya. I dream about better times. I try to clean my apartment. I hope for peace and tomorrow. I'm a lot of things. I'm a drunk man, an emotional man, and I am confused at times.
Wow. That says a lot right there.
It does. It's
aren't we all confused
aren't
at times?
Aren't we all confused at times? And this is inspired by these poems. We ask, tell us what you wonder about, what you worry about, and then we repeat that in the poem. That's why you hear those phrases again.
Mm. What are some of the sections as you were describing? Just give us some of the little headlines of the various chapters.
Sure. The first one is Love Lifted Me, the Power of Love, Keeping Hope Alive, A Shoulder to Lean On, which is Letters to Our Loved Ones, More Than a Conqueror, Overcoming Adversity, Forgiveness is Good for the Soul, Peace and Acceptance. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. That's scriptural, actually.
Mm.
What gives strength to withstand the storm?
Mm.
Yeah.
Very powerful.
Powerful.
Well, you also, your department has done this before.
We have. We saw that putting together stories and small books were actually a really powerful spiritual, we call them interventions, but a spiritual opportunity for people in a different way than maybe traditional religion. Yeah.
And some of the books you've done?
Well, the first one was called A Second Set of Hands, and the name comes from a pediatrician, good buddy, but it was the sense that there was something bigger than us helping to cope with the illness of children. And so it's stories of hope about very sick children.
Mm-hmm.
And the second book was really stories from the kids themselves, which is great. And
in their own voices.
In their own voices. And the third one was actually from our spiritual care volunteers. What is it that made them do this? And what did they learn from the patients? So that was a really powerful book as well.
Wow. Well, this one is equally powerful and something that obviously, besides being helpful and help us gain insight into the experience of these patients, it sounds like it was a healing experience or a healing exercise for them as well.
I agree.
So wonderful.
Thank you.
Wonderful effort on your part. Thank you so very much for coming in and sharing it with us. Now, this is available for people.
It is.
How would they find a copy of this?
Well, if they go to the Upstate website, go to the spiritual care website part of Upstate, and it's listed on.
And we'll
there.
Have a link to it also on
Sounds
our
good.
Own
yeah.
on our own website. Well, thank you so very
Thanks,
much.
Linda.
Very,
thank
very.
You.
Yes, my guest has been Reverend Terry Culbertson. She's from the spiritual care department. The Department of Spiritual Care at Upstate Medical University. Once again, thanks for coming in and thanks for sharing this wonderful effort with us.
Thank you.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Leah Givens is a physician who knows the pain of migraines both personally and scientifically. Here is an excerpt from her essay, Chasing April's Rivers. Winter whimpers, spring insists. The wind outside, a wash of whistles, calling no one home. Birds settle in like sleepy children as the sun tells its nightly mesmerizing story of dying, then coming to life again. It's a comfort, the covers pulled up over closing eyes. I haven't been outside today. For some people, that's heresy. No work, no walk, no class, no coffee shop. Unthinkable to jail oneself within these walls. My muscles don't appreciate it either, giving in to laxity as the hours pass. My skin shivers and begs to bask. But my eyes say, stay away from that abusive light. The source of all life is the source of pain. It sprouts in a spot above my right eye, a slight swelling of tissue that might not be visible to anyone but me. My fingers search and press instinctively as though I were bleeding. Most often the ache guides me to the notch in bone hiding beneath my eyebrow. A nerve courses through there, I've learned, a narrow yet forceful river. One feeds each eye. My left may stand relatively protected, but it isn't immune to destructive flooding. By what? That's the question. Here, the hardest earned knowledge dissolves. Pure pain pulls you back, long past your college days, to the years when true words were just feelings and a syllable had to do. You massage that spot, turgid and hot, and dream of a razor blade for a quick incision. Goo. Goo is what would be extruded. A blighted cousin of the ancient Greek humors. Not pus, nothing infectious, but some similarly dense substance, black like motor oil. Ah, that's what's been ailing you, the surgeon would say. Too much melancholy living in your head. Some bodies are sensitive. You'd nod, feigning understanding. Those aren't modern scientific words of chemicals and nerves, but modern medicine barely knows better, not for sure. The next night inches through the blinds. The nauseating pine sap is back, pooling in that same hollow. Mental messages stick and fail to transmit. another night of no writing, the mind-clearing hike, learning as I go, and leaving a marker behind. This time I refuse to give in, to deepen my human-shaped crater in bed, almost impossible now without a pill or two. As I swallow, I'm grateful to medication for padding this brain-made stabbing. The drug calms the throbbing, but take it too often, I've been warned, and headaches will boomerang, slapping back harder than before. Besides, I'd never have the doses I'd need to tame each of the many migraines. This night is quiet, as far as I can tell, given the muted whooshing in my head. Again, I open the window, hoping for a cool blanket of air. The cat races to the sill to listen for any tucked or fluttering feathers. Minutes pass before a siren flies by, an ambulance in the distance. The body flies to the toilet before I know it. Not you, oh yes, you. Sudden, unexpected vomit, the detested guest of migraine brain. Lentils, not pretty. Ah, well, I'm better than I would be in the 19th century. Survival of the fittest, I shudder at the thought. Modern medicine, I admit, has changed the game. It's hard to remain convinced while my stomach threatens to expel the rest of dinner. The night is black, closer to day, and no sleep of which to speak. As I lie down, the cat bounds in beside me, licking my skin, rapid fire, like this is some great adventure. I pull the sheet over my head, not now. Plop, she flops near the edge of the bed, as if instantly exhausted. I peek out and laugh, despite the ache. She may not speak, but she teaches. When you feel like dying, something or someone brings you back to life.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore Lyme disease and how our sense of internal coherence changes as we age. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.